I grew up in Los Angeles. There's this one hotel called the Cecil Hotel. It is infamous for its location in Skid Row, a part of the city that was developed initially for the railway workers and has since become where the city ushers all the criminals and homeless individuals. Cecil Hotel itself is also where a lot of criminals reside because of the cheap housing and general cheap rent. But one particular story in this hotel is of Elisa Lam. You may or may not have heard of it before, but she was visiting and then suddenly disappeared, only for her body to be found in the water tower at the top of the Cecil Hotel. Her death spurred investigation and captured the minds of people for years. So now, you may be wondering, what happened next? Did they catch the killer? But what about questions like, is her family okay? And thinking, wow, that's awful. A certain genre of entertainment has conditioned us to be so curious about criminal activity that it can precede our empathy. And that genre is true crime. Hello, and welcome to Jackie On, a podcast where I, Jackie, talk about my opinions on a bunch of different topics. This episode is Jackie On True Crime and how I think it can get out of control. I want to be clear, this is not me decrying all of true crime. I don't think listening to a story about solving crimes is bad or makes you a bad person. Rather, I want to explore how it can be multifaceted and sometimes even ends up with worse consequences than intended. And in this way, it gets out of control, because from going to something that is you're listening to, you're watching, maybe curious about, into something that has captured your mind so much that it almost removes you from humanity. And I do think true crime can be strong enough to do something like that. It is something that has personally tugged me in two different directions. One errs more on the side of, oh wow, this is interesting, more investigative. And the other is more like, this feels kind of exploitative of taking human harm for entertainment, and I don't like that. Because true crime can be a complicated topic, I'm not going to pretend I'm the expert on it, because I'm definitely not, but I do realize a lot of people can fall in between these two sides of a spectrum, so to speak, and even fall in between. And so, first of all, I kind of want to get into some of the psychological responses people have in general to violent media. It kind of starts us with a factual basis to then build off and talk about true crime. So research has identified that there's about three types of people who enjoy violent media. The first is the adrenaline junkie. These are people who get a rush from seeing the depictions of violence, maybe enjoy seeing the suffering play out through an audio or visual format. Second is the white knucklers, those who kind of need to grip something so hard their knuckles will turn white. Essentially, the people who are terrified by violence, but still consume it to learn some kind of lesson. It's a safe way to view violence. Risky more psychologically, but you're not actually in physical harm. So while you might feel terrified and scared, you're still being able to pick up on the same signals you would in that environment without, you know, physical harm. And lastly, there's dark copers. These are people who feel a bit both scared and a little rushed when watching violence. Fall somewhere in between. You don't love it and you don't get that burst of adrenaline. You're kind of more coping with the fact that you feel divided. These categories, I think, explain all the groups who consume true crime. I like to think it is particularly white knucklers and dark copers, people looking to learn who are scared, or balance that with maybe a small rush. However, there are certainly people out there who get just a rush for hearing depictions about violence and get into the methods of how to solve crimes. In fact, using these categories, I've kind of further divided up what I personally think is the common listener base for true crime. One is the primarily female audience, and the other is citizen sleuths. Interestingly enough, the majority of people who listen to true crime are women. It's thought that by listening to true crime, women can prepare and prevent some of the horrific violence that occurs from happening to them. Thus, women as a minority share what Professor of Sociology at Yale University, Jeffrey Alexander, calls cultural trauma, in which a group is predisposed to have awareness of increased violence against them. And by listening to true crime, it's a way to rebel and challenge those norms, a sense of regaining control. Women are often dealt with the knowledge of horrific events that could happen to them, as women are often the victims for true crime, disproportionately too. And so by listening to it and consuming this media, it's almost a way to say, hey, no, I'm not going to let this define me. I want to learn how these things might happen, and I want to be able to protect myself. Second group I've kind of divided is because the police only have so much time and energy for each case. Online true crime sleuths often get involved and do research or look at court documents where no one else would spare a glance. This has become so prominent that true crime sleuths and the criminal justice system are now basically entwined together, as people who started out being curious by entertainment start getting involved in trying to solve crimes or open cold cases. It raises the question of whether they see crimes as stories or real life. And so I kind of see the more female audience falling more into the white knucklers category. People who see very real violence play out and are saying, no, I want to rebel, I want to learn, and I want to make sure that I can be protected. Whether or not that's the real outcome, that's certainly some of the mindset that might unconsciously go into listening or consuming true crime. Whereas I see the citizen sleuths as being more as dark copers. There's that little bit of rush, that little bit of excitement that you get from watching this kind of media, or even as an adrenaline junkie, you might feel like, hey, this violence is interesting. But because of the sense of injustice you might feel, you want to get involved. You want to do something. You want to feel responsible for helping someone else out. And so you get involved by trying to solve the crime yourself, which I think is really interesting because most of the people that I talk to about true crime kind of fall into these two groups where either they feel like they need to do something about a true crime story or they're listening to it to gain something or some kind of purpose. But what I think is the real issue with true crime for me is that whether you listen to it to feel scared for education or a little rush, you're turning people's lives into stories. You're treating women as lessons to learn from instead of victims. You're treating crime as a game that you can solve. It's not about a brutal murder anymore because when true crime tells a story, it becomes exaggerated and fictionalized. It becomes entertainment, not reality. I want to give a real example of this. And for that, let's go back to Elisa Lam, who I talked about in the beginning. Eventually, with her case, Pablo Camillo, or Morbid, a heavy metal musician who used a lot of horrific themes in his music, was found to have stayed at the Cecil Hotel the year before Elisa Lam. Internet sleuths, thinking there was some kind of connection, blamed Camillo for her murder, harassing him online, getting him investigated by the police. When, in fact, he was in Mexico during the time that Elisa Lam died, innocent of any crime, but the accusations and online harassment led him to attempt suicide and tainted his reputation as an artist. Based on the ideas that people assumed a killer must look like and act like, an innocent man's life was nearly ruined. Thus, the power of true crime and jurors can go beyond understanding content as entertainment, but rather when activating this sense of justice within them, they're not always right. Because at the end of the day, as people, we go based on assumption, on what we think other people are like or might do. Just because someone has music about murdering people doesn't necessarily mean that they did murder someone. And I think that distinction and a lot of the stereotypes made it difficult for people, especially online, to separate from the reality. Because when you have so much time on your hands, you start looking for connections even when there aren't any to be found. And it went so far as to harass an innocent man. But at the same time, I understand that true crime can take a criminal case hidden by the news and disregarded into a sensation. And sometimes this sensationalism can be everything. In high school, I attended a forensic science pre-college summer camp. I learned all about how to utilize forensic science skills with guest speakers coming in and telling us about different methods and different types of crime. We were taught by a former chief of police, and he brought in one of his police friends, who I believe worked at the FBI for some time. This man talked about a case that he was brought in on near the end of the investigation. It wasn't the bloodiest case, nor the most depraved, but for some reason, it stuck with me. It was about a boy, Kendrick Johnson, who was found dead, suffocated in a gym mat at his school's gym in 2013 after he had apparently tried getting his shoes while the gym mat was rolled up. My instructor's friend walked us through the case as an example of how forensic science was done improperly. The evidence was contaminated, surveillance footage confusing and inconclusive, with two autopsies claiming different things, and possible suspects who were the sons of other FBI agents. The whole case seemed like a cover-up, and my instructor's friend was certainly thought that it was anything but accidental, despite being ruled accidental by both the FBI and the Department of Defense. He wished he could have been consulted on the case sooner, and that maybe that would have prevented a lot of these forensic science issues from occurring. And to me, of course, people can cast that as a true crime case, can exaggerate the details, But the way he told it to me really made it stick in my mind. It's a case I occasionally think about. And I think that is also something with true crime that can be dangerous, is now we're taking people's lives and we're getting the outside world so involved in them that they almost form some kind of connection to the case. And I think that can be good or can be bad. And in this case, as of now, it's actually in front of a federal appeals court after in 2021, public scrutiny led it to be reopened. Johnson's parents never gave up the fight this entire time, filing a lawsuit that got thrown out, and due to the thirst of true crime knowledge, the public didn't give up either. And something about this case, the feeling of injustice and emotions that welled up inside of me at the thought of a boy being trapped inside a gym mat by other cruel people, is so strong. And I think reflecting on my own experience is really interesting because I'm able to admit that the emotions that I feel don't make much sense. Because there's something about being a person and hearing a story about another person that can resonate with you in a weird way, and yet it doesn't relate to you. And I'm sure that's part of the white knuckler's response, hearing horrors that are so painful you have no choice but to feel something, to truly feel human. And I don't tell the story to tell you a true crime story and feed into the fanaticism, but rather that there can be bias in the systems, and the court of public opinion serves as a very strong force in counteracting this. But as the court of public opinion, it can either sway towards harming an innocent person or seeking justice for corruption. Some of us might look at the Elisa Lam case and say, oh yeah, it was obvious that it wasn't that heavy metal musician. And then some of us can look at the Kendrick Johnson case and say, oh yeah, well, it's clear that this was a cover-up. And so it's really easy, without seeing evidence, to draw conclusions based on what you think is true and what isn't true. So as the public, our attention to sway this way and that way can do a lot for people's lives, both helpful and harmful. And even in the act of calling it the Elisa Lam case and the Kendrick Johnson case, dehumanizes the victims who are at the center of these stories. Because it's about injustice instead of trying to remember a victim for being a person. And I think that's where true crime can almost desensitize and dehumanize people and create a society in which we're kind of in this weird loop of both seeking justice, but also unwilling to seek humanity. And while this seems very dark and very, very much at one end of the spectrum, I don't think it's all dark all the time when it comes to true crime. I do think this is kind of the worst case scenario and a true risk that does occur. Because when we leave things up to the public to decide, it really depends on which way the public sways. And you can never really foresee that. And I really think that some cases may be more obvious than others when the facts line up and when they don't, but it's a very fine line to be walking. And extending this point, many people assume a true crime story ends the moment a criminal is captured. Just because a bad guy was found doesn't necessarily mean that the case ends. It very much reminds me of the grieving process in general, where maybe the funeral's over, but that doesn't mean that the pain's gone away, or that the harm goes away, or that someone's done grieving. Those harms and those feelings still continue on years and years afterwards. And so when we think about true crime, and we think about listening to a podcast, let's say, and we hear, oh yeah, they caught the bad guy, it was this guy, we end the episode, we feel satisfied. We hear a story, and it's come to a conclusion. But because human lives are not just a line that starts and stops, they go on for quite some time, even beyond living. I think it's important that true crime stories, when they're told from point A to point B, neglect the fact that there's so much to come afterwards. And so it gives us the idea that these cases are just representative snapshots in time, and yet they're sold as though they're in the entire story, and that can also be dangerous. So while trying to reopen cold cases is one thing, treating a life as entertainment is another. There are countless examples of true crime being the reason why a certain individual was brought to justice to the end, that someone feels safer walking the streets, or a family finally feels hope at a crime being solved. But the way violence is turned into entertainment can also lead to people's lives being treated as fiction, when in reality they are far from it. So while stories and true crime are not going to be going away anytime soon, they also present us opportunities to take a step back and really see the people that are at the core of the story and not just the story itself. with that, I appreciate you for listening to this episode of Jackie On. I apologize for it being a little darker, but I do think this is something that needs to be addressed and needs to be talked about more. All that being said, I will see you in the next episode.